Hello there, I'm Ian Danter, and you're very welcome to a new show called The Commentator's Curse. I've been doing football commentaries for various radio stations for over 20 years now, and I thought it'd be an opportunity with this programme to have a chat to a couple of people each episode who do the same job as me, only entirely different, because there are so many different commentators, so many different jobs out there to be had, so many different levels of experience, male, female, old, young. It's an extraordinary breadth of people that I get to meet who do the same job as I do. And we all kind of forge a weird friendship where we would never, ever meet down the pub, but we meet in a press box or we meet at the side of a pitch and forge a friendship that's really nice and somehow tight despite the limited time we all spend in each other's company. And of course, I get bombarded with questions about people who want to know what life is like as a commentator. How did I get this job? How did other people get this job? And I can tell you, everybody's route is as different as everybody else's. So a couple of people each week will chat to me about their life and times, what's going on right now, what used to happen, all that sort of stuff. And we're just going to keep it light and casual. And my first two guests, I'm delighted to say, are two really top-class commentators who I've got to know over the years. First of all, Ian Crocker's with us, who works for Sky predominantly these days on their Scottish Premiership, but also does Premier League commentaries for the Sky Network as well. Hello, Croc.
Hi, Dan. How you doing, mate?
Very good, sir. It's lovely to speak to you. And also with us is the BBC's lead football commentator on Match of the Day and European tournaments. Mr. Guy Mowbray's with us as well. Good morning, Guy.
Hi, Dan. All good?
Yes, everything's lovely here.
Excellent.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. The season starts early for some, but Croc, even for you, you had a ridiculous start to the season with the SPFL, with two games in one day.
Yeah, that was unusual to say the least. We had Rangers playing Livingston at 1:30, Hearts Celtic at 8 o'clock. So yeah, two in one day, which was actually quite enjoyable. I have done it once before. We did an Oldham game years ago at 12 o'clock and then St Johnstone Kilmarnock at 6 o'clock. That game, St Johnstone Kilmarnock, finished 0-0, nothing happened. So it was always going to be a bit of a come down after an Old Firm, but made even worse by the fact that it finished 0-0.
How on earth did you get to Perth for a 6 o'clock kickoff after an Old Firm?
Yeah, I wondered that myself, to be fair, but we would have left probably half to, it's not that far, Perth, it's only an hour or so, if that.
Okay.
So, probably speeded a little and made it. And yeah, it was really weird doing the two on the opening day of the season, which of course starts early in Scotland as well. But, you know, you get the adrenaline, you get the buzz. And, you know, they asked if I was okay doing it. And obviously, as a commentator, we always say we're okay doing anything, don't we? So, yeah, bring it on, you know.
Guy, you ever done two in one day? I mean, I've done Europa League games back to back, those sort of 6 o'clock and then 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
But that's in the comfort of a little booth somewhere in
there. Yeah, that's the only time I've done it, is the off tubes. I've done it a few times, not for quite a while, though. But yeah, I've done two off the telly back to back. Which, the last time I did, I had a similar experience to Crocs, actually. The second game was a stinker. you'd prefer it the other way around, really.
Sometimes, if you do those back-to-back games, you because there's about 12 other people with you all doing something similar. I used to work at this place called Delta Trade, which was by the new Wimbledon Theatre. You'd come out for your half-time cup of tea in your second game, and somebody would invariably say to you, what was your first game? And you've already forgotten what the first game was.
I don't know about you, I forget games. I have a little 15-minute window after full-time where I have to process it, and I'm usually scurrying down for Match of the Day to do the post-match interviews, and I have a window where I can't quite process what I've just seen. It's too soon. And I sometimes think about managers as well. Are they the same when they come out and talk to you immediately afterwards? Should we not give them half an hour to actually process it and think, you know, where are we? What have we got to say? I think we get more out of them that way. I think it's a little bit too immediate sometimes. And I had Liverpool against Stoke, which was also 0-0 actually, a few years ago. And I rushed downstairs to be confronted with Kenny Dalglish waiting for me. And I genuinely was thinking, what happened? So I asked him sort of quite a banal, easy question to start with. And he basically responded with, didn't you watch the game? And I had nothing because I thought, well, of course I did. But I genuinely can't remember what happened. And it's only just happened. And that was quite uncomfortable. That happens a lot.
Yeah. You two I have to interview managers on occasion, but I don't have to do it in the glare of television cameras that are going to be shown to millions later that night on, say, Match of the Day or on Sky's, you know, Red Button or on the highlight show, Pick of the Day. That's a big, yeah, and as you say, that's a responsibility all of its own. You've just done 90 minutes full tilt, and then you've got to completely reconfigure your brain.
It is my least favourite part of the job. If I was just there as a reporter and that was my job, I'd love it. I'd absolutely love it. I love talking to these guys and asking them questions and finding out what's what. But when you've just done a commentary, you really are. It might be just me, can't handle it, but I'm scrambled after a match. If I did it an hour after the game, I'd be fine. But straight afterwards, and you've rushed through the crowd to get down there as well, especially at the moment, actually, because we're doing it outside, and now the crowds are back, they're still there. So I was faced with interviewing Marcelo Bielsa last week on the touchline with his interpreter at Old Trafford. I couldn't hear a word he said, not a word. And I suspect he couldn't hear a word I said either, because the Man United fans were still there giving it plenty.
Yeah, it's the least favourite part of the job for me as well, because I think the whole process of interview managers, and they have to do so many interviews as well, they're bound to get bored after a while. But actually thinking, I always start with a fairly banal, what did you make of the game question? And then sometimes when you're thinking of a second question, they kind of answer it and you've got to rethink off the back of the game. I remember doing Bobby Robson years ago, and I said, what did you make of the game, Bobby? And he did one answer lasting 3 minutes, covering everything in the game. I didn't have to come back with a second question. And I was thinking, if only all interviews were like that.
Oh, yes. Sam Allardyce is a belter for that. He would do a complete summary of the match. One question, that'll do. I remember what I did, interviewed Sam after a game once way back when he was at Bolton. And my one question that I asked him in the 4 minutes that we had was, well, and that was it. That was it. Best one I ever did.
Well, that's money for old rope then, isn't it? That's money for jam. That sort of gig. Colin Lee at Walsall was always a good one for me for asking one question, and off he went like Eddie Izzard on about several different tangents and eventually came back to the point 4 minutes later. But I don't know who you found the most difficult, but... Well, David O'Leary for me was impossible to deal with when he was at Villa. I actually found him rude to the point where, you know, he would, if you called you my friend during the course of an answer, then you knew he was giving you a custard pie and he didn't want to talk to you any longer. He was doing post-match interviews on the half turn, like he was waiting to get away. Rude, man.
I can't think. I wouldn't name it, just in case. But yeah, there have been a few prickly ones over the years. But they're actually, it's a decent bunch by and large now, to be honest. In the Premier League at the moment, we seem to be reasonably blessed. I don't know if it's the way the world works and the media savviness has improved amongst the managers and coaches. I'm not sure, but it's certainly a lot easier than it used to be.
I used to love interviewing Fergie, though. I did him quite a lot. It mainly in the treble-winning season when I did their 3 o'clock Saturday games, when there were more of them back then. And I used to love interviewing him because you knew you had to be on your toes. One mistake and one stupid question, and that was that. And I think that kind of helped me raise the game in doing interviews. And yeah, I think that nowadays they're pretty good bunch. There's always one or two, you know, that, I mean, I think the fact they have to do so many interviews, they have to do Sky, BBC, Talk, Club TV, you know, you can see some of them visibly wilting, looking at the watch as if to say, get a move on.
Well, this is the problem we get on radio, because more often than not, we're the last in line. By the time they come to us, they've already spoken to not just the Premier, the pre-LP productions and Match of the Day, and they've done a flash interview. So, yeah, they're about to answer the same questions.
I think Arsene Wenger, after a defeat, was never easy. Probably the worst loser I've ever encountered, which is not a bad thing, by the way. But he was probably the worst loser. He was very hard to talk to after Arsenal had lost, and he was pretty grouchy about it. The worst one I ever had was, I think it was the second one I ever did. This was in the early 90s, and I was covering York City against Exeter for Club Call, which was my first port of call. And for people listening to this who are younger, that was pre-internet, when people used to ring up a phone line to get the latest news on their club. And, you know, 24 hours a day and all that at some ridiculous price per minute. I reported on games part-time on a weekend. I used to do York City, Hull City, the old Leeds United game. And it was either my second or certainly very early on, I was doing York City against Exeter. And I was waiting outside the dressing room to get a word for Exeter Club Call with the late, great Alan Ball, who was the Exeter boss at the time. Never met anybody from the 1966 World Cup winning team that I'd grown up hearing so much about. So this was going to be my first encounter with them. Now, BBC Radio Devon, I think it was BBC Radio Devon, it might have been the independent station, had asked me, because they had a long trek, so they after half an hour waiting, they were on the road and said, would you mind getting something and sending it to us? And I said, yeah, I can do that. Great. Yeah, fine. I'm getting an extra sort of 15, 20 quid for it. So I thought, yeah, this is perfect. Yeah, I'll do that. So I waited an hour for Alan Ball to come out of the Exeter City dressing room after a 3-0 away defeat all the way from Devon to North Yorkshire. He wasn't happy. He kept his players in. You could hear the walls shaking. And I waited there for an hour. And I was the only one there in the drafty, brick-lined corridors of Bootham Crescent, now sadly in the process of being knocked down. And when he finally came out, he walked past me, traditional flat cap on, as he always had. And I very politely said, excuse me, Mr. Ball, have you got a moment for radio? And before I'd even finished the sentence, I got, no, fuck off. And that was the first time I met a member of the 1966 World Cup winning team, and it will stay with me forever. And he was well within his rights to say that. He wasn't very happy, and I understand why. But yeah, things like that give you a great grounding for later. You can kind of deal with anything. At the time, I remember being pretty wounded by it. I thought, what have I done wrong? What have I done?
For budding commentators who are, you know, listening to this and thinking, well, what's, there is no on the job. Well, it is on the job training.
You don't actually get as a
young pup. You're thrust into this. You're not given any pointers other than, I mean, Tom Ross used to tell me when I first started working for him, and Croc will probably echo these words, when I first started working for BRNB, he just said, who, what, why, where, when? Any question that you ask has to contain one of those five prefixes. But other than that, I had absolutely no guidance about how to talk to the managers I first encountered. That just added to the terror for me.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah. But I was very lucky. Alan Little at York City was very helpful with me, and Peter Reid at Sunderland in the early days, who I had a few run-ins with as well, but he was great, and it taught me to deal with how to cope with the knockbacks, and yeah, a really good grounding, and you have to go through it. You have to. It's the only way of getting any good at this.
On the Birmingham Beat Dance, as you know, when I was doing radio there and we had Barry Fry and Big Ron, I mean, you couldn't have asked for two better characters to interview. I've so many fond memories of those days, especially Bazza, because he was just so funny, wasn't he, with every line.
He was an extraordinary character. That this was when I first got to know your voice, of course, Croc, because this would be in my mid-20s, and I wasn't in radio at the time, but the season 94-95, when Birmingham City, my club, had been relegated to what is now League One. Barry Fry had taken over the season before, couldn't keep us in the Championship. But that season, where you were the lead commentator on BRNB and Capital Gold in Birmingham, with Tom Ross as your summariser, and you and he went around the country watching Birmingham. You went to Stockport, Edgeley Park. You went to Bristol Rovers, were playing at Twerton Park, I think. You went down to Plymouth, here, there and everywhere. York City as well. I think you went up to York.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
But yeah. That I think, listening to you and Tom, and I don't wish to blow smoke, but that was what's, well, I'd love to do. That job just sounds idyllic.
Yeah, that was one of my most memorable seasons, you know, in the third tier of English football. And, you know, I remember when they went down and Barry, he couldn't keep him up, and he said, hey, I told you I'd take you out of this division. that was brilliant. And there were so many. I remember a game against Brentford at St Andrews Dance. You'll remember it. And the atmosphere that night, I think it was just after they'd won the Auto Windscreens Shield. They beat Brentford and were on course for promotion. And the atmosphere at St Andrews that night was something else. As we know, it's a great patch for football. It's the West Midlands.
Well, yes, it was. It became my, you know, training ground, doing the job that I did. But you guys started in different areas of the country. You came to Birmingham in the end, Croc. We'll come back to that. But Guy, you started pretty much where you are. You mentioned Club Call and for York. When was the moment that things kind of switched gears for you?
Pretty quickly, actually. I was working part-time. I was working at John Smith's Brewery, actually, in the group debt recovery department, which was an interesting job. I used to compile all the spreadsheets. Again, everything I've done seems to be just sort of on the hoof, made up, self-taught, and learn as you go on. And I used to work out which landlords hadn't paid for their beer that month and then send the bailiffs around. So it was it's quite an interesting job. I actually got offered that full time, but at the same time, I was on a Saturday doing club call and local radio as a hobby, really, and it was almost as a way of getting into the game for free, really. That was it. And I was still holding out hopes of, ridiculous hopes, having never been anywhere near, of all I wanted to do was play football. That's all I wanted to do. And I was never anywhere near good enough. And it actually, I started out as a throwaway line from a dad who was sort of thinking, you know, what are you going to do with your life? And I sort of hesitated and he just went, look, you are not good enough to play football. And that was the penny drop moment, actually. That was it.
What age was that?
I was 19, 20. Okay. And he sort of said, he was a coach, by the way. He knew the game. He was a qualified PE teacher and had got his badges and all that. So I thought, why couldn't you save me 6 years of grief and told me this when I was in my early teens? It would have caused, you know, it would have been a lot easier for me. And then he said, look, there are other, you know, people in the game through what you've done. There are other ways of staying in this profession, in this sport. So, so hang on, light bulb moment. Here we go. Let's put all my energies into that. So yeah, cut a long story short, my weekends were, I used to go into the computer room. This was in the days before offices had computers at a desk, at every desk. They had a dedicated computer room at the brewery that nobody ever went in. So I used to do all my work for them sort of Monday to Thursday, and Friday I'd go in there and nobody would bother me all day and get all my prep done for the weekend's games that I was covering. So it was great. I managed to do that, which was wonderful.
So this is mid-90s then, is it?
The early 90s, yeah, very early 90s, sort of 93, 94.
So pre-internet,
Yeah, absolutely. And that's when it went. And from there, just meeting people. As we've talked about earlier, I mean, the thing I missed most during lockdown was the company of the likes of you two, you know, in the press room beforehand and chewing the fat and getting to know things, and it all helps with your preparation as well. And yeah, just through knowing people, oh, will you do this for us next weekend? Oh, yeah, I can do that for you. Yeah, and it sort of spiraled from there, really. And my first, I did York City for felt quite a while, but it's probably only a year or so, really, looking back. And then very quickly, the station I was working for, we got a station in the northeast that they acquired, and I went up to Sunderland and covered Sunderland for pretty much five full seasons. And that was my starting point, Sun FM and the Metro Radio in the northeast. And yeah, it was brilliant. It's funny what Crocs was saying. I look back now and all the things that all of us are lucky to have done, they are still the best days of my life. I think you're of that age as well, in your 20s, your footloose and fancy free, you know, and they were without doubt that every working day was a holiday. It was hard work, or we think back now as it's hard work, but it didn't feel like it. It absolutely had a ball doing that. And it was in the Peter Reid days where Sunderland were up, they were down, they were up. There was that famous playoff final against Charlton in 98, which is still one of my fondest memories ever. Even though they lost, you know, I think that game was, we were talking about Mickey Gray earlier, you know, that was his moment. And actually, it was awful for him. It was the worst moment of his life, of his career. And yet, that game is even more in Northeast folklore because they lost, bizarrely. It's the way it is in the Northeast, isn't it? It seems to be that way. It's never changed. It's a cursed patch.
Kind of the self-flagellation that Sunderland fans have for themselves.
Absolutely. But I loved it. I loved it and still do. And obviously I have a major, major, major soft spot for Sunderland to this day and always will have.
Okay. So, Croc, you grew up in the Southwest, but did your radio career start down Weymouth Way?
No. I left Weymouth at 17, sleepy little village, and thought I'd go to London, which, when I look back now, seems a ridiculous thing to do, and it was a bit scary at times. Got a job with Whittaker's Publishers, who did Whittaker's Almanac in sales. Did that for a couple of years, trying to get into the BBC mainly, or whoever would take me, but mostly the BBC. Got a job at the BBC eventually. It was an office job in the locations unit, where they just used to churn out contracts for location filming. Kept applying for broadcasting jobs. Never got one. Got a few interviews, couldn't land one. They might have had a point, in fairness. But then I won a competition on Essex Radio to become Tannoy announcer at West Ham, who I started supporting when I was a kid because they had the same colours as Weymouth, if only life was that simple now. And from there, doing the Tannoy, which obviously was a dream job for me back in, that would have been 86, I got that just after West Ham finished third the season before. And then I met Jonathan Pearce and the guys from Capital Radio, and they offered me a job. So I left the BBC to go and work for Capital. Then they brought over BRNB, so I moved up there. And then started doing stuff for Sky as well. So everyone's got a different route, haven't they? But sometimes it is about being in the right place at the right time.
That's funny. That's funny what you just said, Croc, actually, because you're saying you tried to get in at the BBC. And I remember when I was trying to get a job just in local radio at the time, I think I've still got them somewhere. I wrote letters to Sky Sports, to the BBC, to ITV, to all the major players, basically asking for a job. And these were letters, not emails. These were actual hand... I got replies from a couple, but what was I thinking? I had not one jot of experience other than being an average football player and knowing a bit about it. That was it. But I think there is no right or wrong way. Take a punt. You never know where it might get you.
Yeah. This is true. I remember when I was at Capital, I'd done a breakfast shift one day, and there was a press conference at Terry Venables Club, Scribes, in London for the launch of Sky Premier League coverage. And it was Monday, so everyone was off apart from whoever did the breakfast shift, which was me. And I remember Jonathan Pearce said, "You're going to have to go to this launch and get some interviews." I was like, "Christ, I've been up since 4 o'clock. Can't be asked. I want to go home. Been a long weekend." He said, "No, Capital's got to be represented." So I went along, even though I didn't want to, like utterly knackered, and ended up sitting next to Vic Wakeling, the head of Sky Sports, at the lunch. Because I was so tired and all that, I thought, I'm just going to hit the red wine here. So I hit the red wine and ended up saying, Vic, and I'd hardly done any commentaries at that point. I go, "Vic, I'm going to be working for you one day at Sky. I'm going to be doing commentaries for you." And he must have thought, "God, who have I landed here, sat next to me?" And about a month later, somebody from Sky rang saying that Vic says, "Would you like to do Bundesliga commentaries for Sky?" So that's how I got into Sky, and that was... I could easily not have gone to that launch, and who knows what would have happened.
Extraordinary. I mean, you two have some commonality between you. We talk about the good times, but there's also bad times that occur, which can leave a commentator feeling a little bit, what next? And you both work for Setanta Sports, and of course that's a company that famously collapsed in the early 2000s. I don't know whether that left either of you feeling particularly vulnerable or whether it was just one of those things?
I didn't do a great deal for them. I did the old bit. My one was ITV Digital. That was where I was when that sort of collapsed. Now, I was okay. My contract was with ITV in general doing other stuff, so it didn't hit me directly like it did a lot of people. But I do remember in 2004 when ITV lost the rights that they had, and you know, it was the Premier League, basically. I think we're just... commemorating 20 years or whatever of the Premiership this week, which actually was a much maligned programme. Editorially, it wasn't bad at all. But obviously, because of that 7 o'clock start point, it never got off the ground and never really worked and never recovered from that. But I was proud to work on that show. And when they lost the rights, I was a little bit like that then, because I sort of thought, well, I've only been in television relatively few years. I didn't have the contacts I had now. I didn't have the experience I have now. What do I do now? I mean, and it literally was. And my watershed moment was Euro 2004, when I got the call for my schedule. And I was contracted to do Euro 2004 in Portugal. And I got the call and it said, "Right, okay, have you got a pen? Here's your list." And it said, ITV2 on whatever date it was of June. You're doing Holland v Latvia. That's in Braga. So I went, "Great stuff, right?" I wrote that down. And then they said, "And that's it." I went, "Sorry?" And they went, "Yeah, that's your game. What you'll be doing is you'll be in London just on standby in case the line goes down for the other games." So I basically had to sit there and prep pretty much all the games without ever getting on air. And when that tournament finished, I went home. I remember going to Braga, to Porto where I was staying, and then Braga on my own. And the other guys came in who I knew them all. And, you know, Jim Beglin and Peter Drury and what have you. They came in to the hotel I was in. And I deliberately, and it's not like me at all, I stayed in my room and kept away. I didn't want to see anybody. I was embarrassed. I was actually embarrassed to be there. So I thought, I don't belong here, quite clearly. And that was the lowest I've probably ever been. And came back home after that tournament. The end of that month, my contract finished with ITV after 5 years there. And to this day, I never heard a word. That was it. I was working for them one day, not the next. I never heard a word of explanation about it, ever. I was very fortunate the BBC had started Match of the Day, and from 2004 they've had the rights, and that was the start point. Younger people might not remember, but there used to be just three games on a Saturday night where commentary was, you know, that was it. The three games where the cameras were at, The others were just one camera and a voiceover. But the BBC that year started sending to every single game, and it was the time when every single game had proper coverage, every single Premier League game. So they needed people and got in touch with me. I didn't have to go to them and said, well, you know, you've been doing it. Would you like to do it for us? So, you know, out of darkness cometh light and all that. But that was the lowest I'd been. I just remember being in my hotel room in Porto, feeling just embarrassed, thinking, well, that's it then. That's it then. That's me done. And I'd been doing it, you know, 7-8 years at that point in television. But yeah, that was definitely the lowest I'd be.
Well, yeah, Setanta would be mine, Dan. Obviously, I made a big decision to leave Sky and go there based on the fact they're offering Premier League games, and you know, that some really good guys ahead of me at Sky, so I thought I'd give it a go. Seemed like a good idea at the time, and then a kind of new boss came in with different ideas. It's like the player who signs for a club, and then the manager leaves the next day. There was a bit of that went on, and yeah, I was actually on holiday in Lanzarote when got the news that they were going bust. But out of it, as Guy said, I got a bit of freelance. I got to go to World Cup, which is second nature to you guys, but of course Sky don't cover them, so we're not normally there. But I went to South Africa in 2010 with ITV, just did a few games, which was great fun. And then thankfully Sky opened the door again to get back in. But yeah, mostly more ups than downs in this business. And generally I've been on the right side of the rights over the years, which we're all dependent on. So mostly it's worked out pretty well.
The other thing that you two guys in particular, you have, I mean, everybody has pressures as a commentator, regardless of experience, gender or age. So, and that's what I want to get into in this show, you know, the different feelings that people have about what irks them or what puts them under pressure. And for you two guys, I think there's two specific things that I can pinpoint. Croc, with yourself, I think what you've always had, what you've had to do, I don't know how many Old Firm games you've now covered, I'm sure you'll know.
61, but, I think it is.
There you go. 61 Old Firm games.
Oh, wow.
Which you've covered, and I know it, straight down the line every single time. You're a West Ham fan. You have no dog in that particular fight. And I'm really conscious of how careful you felt you've had to tread with what you say on air or what you write in a tweet, or because you have no margin for error when the accusations of bias get inevitably slung your way. It's outrageous sometimes.
Yeah, some of the post-match reaction from whoever's lost usually is can be pretty bad on Twitter, but I think you've got to have a thick skin to be on Twitter in the first place. And when I don't even bother reading all of them because it's the same old, you know, bias this, bias that. And I used to take a couple of people on and say, listen, you're the biased one, not me. I'm straight down the middle calling it as it is, you know. And but sometimes you get 50-50, you know, you're biased towards Rangers, you're biased towards Celtic. And you think, if I'm getting 50-50, then that's good. I'm doing my job okay. But I've got so kind of used to that reaction. And, you know, there's a lot of keyboard warriors out there. And when you actually in the games, you know, generally people are fine. But Twitter is Twitter, isn't it? If you don't like it, don't go on it, and so on. And generally, I quite like the banter that you have. I don't use it as much as I did, possibly for that reason. I mean, you know, there were some incidents last season when the level of tweets that I got about a certain incident was just ridiculous. I just thought, you know what, I use it around football and the games I'm doing generally. I've definitely cut down the use of it, which is bad, I suppose. But generally, you know, as long as it's a bit of banter, but when it gets a bit silly and out of hand, you know, what can you do?
And you don't get it from Hearts and Hibs fans in the same way, do you? You know, the Edinburgh derby has nowhere near the vitriol.
No, not at all. Well, you know, the history of Rangers and Celtic obviously is actually unique, and sure, it's a fixture that carries a lot of baggage, most of which I would never understand, even in all the time I've been doing it. I've got no time for that. But as a sporting occasion, it is such a one-off, and there is, to me, nothing like the atmosphere. And obviously, it was so bizarre being played behind closed doors, and it actually did take a bit of edge off the players, you know, not only in that game, but in other games as well. But we've got one coming up at the end of the month, and it'll be a full house at Ibrox, so that'll be fun.
Well, it'll be an experience, and a unique experience, as every Old Firm game is. Guy, with you, the pressure you have is simply being the person that you are, that is to say, BBC's lead commentator when it comes to major tournaments, the big Premier League games, you know, it brings its own pressure, it brings its own criticisms. I mean, there's Croc and I talking about social media. You've had your issues with people giving you totally unnecessary grief for the most trivial.
It's the same thing, and it's the same as Croc just said. I mean, yeah, I don't get it, but any particular fixture like that, that's unbelievable. And 61 Old Firms, that's incredible. That really is. Yeah. Take my metaphorical hat off to Croc for that. I'm like Ian. I've sort of come away from it a little bit, not as a conscious decision. It's just kind of happened organically that I don't look at it as often as I did. I don't give as much credence to it as I did, which I think you've just got to do for your own sanity, quite honestly. And it's the same sort of issues. You wouldn't get as far as any of us three have got in this profession if we were still with that fan mentality of, I want them to win. As soon as any game starts, and I would do this if I was covering York City, the team I grew up watching, you know, I would do this if I was covering them tomorrow. As soon as any game starts, and I do it with England. I do it, people, I get a lot from Scotland and Wales about being biased towards England. England's a little bit different because you are conscious that the majority of the population watching are wanting a result to happen. So you do kind of go into local radio, in quotes, mode a little bit, yes, while still calling the game down the line. I would do the same, incidentally, if I was doing a Scotland game or a Wales game or a Northern Ireland game or a Republic of Ireland game. I would do exactly the same because I'm conscious that people are wanting them to win. But otherwise, with every other like Premier League game, I am totally, 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 and we all are, straight down the middle. The game starts, it is one team against another. I just want, and I wouldn't even say I want a good game necessarily, because I don't know about you two, I never see a bad game. I've done that much work for it, I've invested that much, but I will always find something in the most dour of games. I'll find something to keep me invested and entertained. And just as an aside, while we're talking about that, makes me laugh at the end of the season when the awards are handed out for commentary of the season. It always goes to somebody who's done like a 4-3. And you think, no. Fred next door could have done that commentary. The commentary of the season is a dour 0-0 that stunk the place out. And you have kept the audience and kept them engaged and entertained and listening to it. That's the commentary of the season.
I agree. I learned that. You're absolutely correct in what you say. A 0-0 as a commentator is always something to keep you motivated. 0-0 as a reporter is, I will admit, is a total thing, because you're sat there, you're not saying anything, you're just watching Stoke against Plymouth, the Britannia, some years ago.
Why is it always Stoke? Why do all people always put poor old Stoke?
I bear no ill will, but Stoke or Plymouth fans that were there that night at the Brit, it was February, it was freezing cold, you know, the thermals weren't having an effect. It was a dreadful 0-0. And again, this goes back to my old boss and Croc's old boss, Tom Ross, who, if there was a game going on where there was precious little to report, if Tony Butler from BR&B came to him for an update, he would go, Birmingham 0, Port Vale 0, no goals, no action, nothing. That was it.
Brilliant. Perfect.
Of his 5 seconds.
Perfect. I'll tell you what, I'd rather do a 0-0. You know, if you give me a 0-0 tomorrow, I'd rather do that than a 6 or 7-0. They're the boring ones to me, where there's no contest. It's not a competition.
Yeah.
You know, all you want from them is, please get 10.
Yeah.
So give me a story. Please go on, keep going, because this is ridiculous. If it stays 6, it's dull. Please get 10. I've had those before. But, yeah, the criticisms... Most people you meet face-to-face are absolutely lovely and genuinely interested in it. It is the social media stuff. It's people just venting their spleen. As Croc said, when they've lost, usually, you get the brunt of it. I tend to find as well, having done, as we all have, a little bit of presenting, I get more abuse from commentary than presenting. And I think it's almost because people, when they see you, they know you're a person. And I think sometimes we're just a voice. We might as well be a robot. You know, we're just a voice. And I think it's very easy. We're faceless. So, that's not human. Well, they don't think, obviously, there's no thought attached. But it's easy to abuse somebody you haven't seen. You can't put a face to. Very easy.
Oddly enough, in for me in radio, I've had more abuse as a presenter than as a commentator.
Oh, right, okay.
I've worn both hats down the years and cover, let's say if you're covering a drive time show that Adrian would normally be presenting for TalkSport, and, you know, that show is all about opinions, and that's what generates the tweets that come in that are, you know, abusive. I think commentaries, I've been fairly, I've probably got more abuse from managers post match than I have from but that's because I'm not as high profile as you two. You two are in a very, you know, with Celtic Rangers for you, Croc, and with, you know, an England Euro 2020 final guy, that's a whole different, for television, for BBC One, that's a whole different level.
I don't think about it. I'm sure we're all the same. You do the prep as you do for any other game, and you just do it. And I don't think of the viewers. The only time I've ever thought about it was actually before the World Cup semi-final in Russia. And Mark Chapman, before the game, said, you do realise you could be, you know, the Kenneth Wolstenholme moment, and that could be you. And I just said, yeah, cheers, chappers, thanks. I hadn't actually put that in my head, and I quickly got it out of my head. And I did the same this summer, actually, as well, because you don't think about that. You are literally talking to your co-commentator and one person at home. That's it. And essentially, what we all do, we're talking to ourselves, basically, aren't we? Yes. That's what we do. Essentially, what we do for a living is talk to ourselves. That's how ridiculous it is.
Which leads me on quite beautifully to the next thing I wanted to get into with you guys is, you know, the verbal diarrhea that we spout to ourselves. I'm not one for, I've never pre-scripted a line in my life. And there's Kenneth Wolstenholme, famously, they think it's all over, it is now, was never written down. It's a glorious little epithet that popped into his head. I mean, I'm presuming you guys are on the same page as me, that you just let it happen. But are there any moments that stick out where you, well, do you know what? Even though I've criticised myself, that didn't sound too bad. That came out pretty much the way I would have wanted it to. As a little moment, as a little nugget of commentary, does anything stand out?
Doing ourselves down here, aren't we? Probably not. No. No, I forget them quite quickly, which is a horrible thing to say about yourself, really, isn't it? But we do so many, we're always on to the next, for one thing. And no, I've never, ever... I did it once in local radio days in 1996. I thought, if Craig Russell scores for Sunderland today, I'm going to say this. And I did, and I made a mangled mess of it. Because we're not actors. And you don't know how it's going to pan out. It will never pan out how you think it'll pan out. So I never, ever... The only thing I semi-script is at the handover at the top. Yeah. Thanks, Gary, and off we go. And just so I've got something to say before the game starts, that's it. I will never, ever do anything in-game, because the Wolstenholme thing is the one you've just said. That's the perfect example of how you cannot ever script a commentary. We're not actors. It's live as it happens, and that's it. The one you're saying about the moment, the one that I shouldn't really... Should I confess to this? It sounds quite bitter when I say it like this. Sergio Aguero's goal in 2012. Would I have done it differently? No, because I couldn't do it differently. I was there. It was that moment. It happened. It makes me cringe when I hear it back. And again, the sort of embarrassed feeling, a little bit of ego maybe kicking in. I was at Man City at the end of the season last season. And because Martin Tyler was live on Sky, his is the one that's remembered, even though arguably mine's probably been heard by many more millions of people. Now, we did virtually, it wasn't word for word, but it was pretty much the same commentary, actually. But what was embarrassing for me was it was being lauded as Aguero's moment, and here is the man who made it happen. And I'm sitting down for Martin thinking, yeah, I did that as well. But and I sort of skulked out the ground thinking, oh, well, I might as well not be here. And that's there's a little bit of that with Match of the Day sometimes.
Yeah.
Because you're not live for the Premier League, you do feel a little bit second class a little bit, even though it is the programme to work on. It is the flagship programme. I wouldn't swap it. You know, it's brilliant. But you do sometimes feel a bit, well, they've got it, not me. I'm just the supporting cast here today. So there's a little bit of that comes in, which is purely probably just ego, but there's a little bit of that. So there are frustrations. I don't know. I got lauded for a few lines at the World Cup and a few this summer. I couldn't remember them, if I'm honest. They just come out and they're gone and you're on to the next game, which is Yeah, as I said earlier, quite a damning indictment. I think we're all our own worst self-critics, aren't we? We don't need anybody to tell us. We know. Mm. We know when it's good and we know when it's bad.
I went through a phase for a little while where I did start thinking, oh, I'll say that, I'll say this. But then, as Guy said, nothing ever pans out how you think it's going to be. It's 90 minutes of ad-libbing. You don't know what's coming next. I remember doing the 2016 Scottish Cup final. Great game, Hibs-Rangers. Hibs, it was 2-2. And Hibs hadn't won the Cup for 114 years. And I did think, I thought, they're going to do this. I just had a feeling when it was 2-2. And I did think, I need to get something in my mind ready for that, because nobody's been able to call it for 114 years. So I better get it right. And I got a line in about standing on the brink of history when they scored in stoppage time. And it worked, you know, without wishing to sound big-headed, it worked. And I was pleased with it. But they were satisfied. Another Cup final, funny enough, Rangers-Celtic 2002. And it was also in stoppage time. Neil McCann got the ball down the flank, and it was 2-2. And I said, is there going to be a twist in the tail? And he put the cross in, and Peter Lovenkrantz headed it in, and everyone went, wow, what a great line. But I was thinking of the 100 times previously where I said, is there going to be a twist in the tail? And bugger all happened. So, you know.
Nobody remembers that. Exactly. That's the beauty of it, isn't it? That's the beauty of it, isn't it, though, Croc? When you do it, and for example, you know, a corner last minute, and you might say, oh, yeah, it's such as that, is there going to be twins? Then we get accused on Match of the Day, ridiculously, from people who still think the earth is flat, that we do it afterwards, which is utter nonsense. As you two know, we're there live, it's all live. Yes. And I get, well, clearly you do, because you knew there was going to be a goal scored. And I've tried to point out to people, no, if I'd said that and there hadn't been a goal, A, it wouldn't have made the edit, and B, you wouldn't have remembered it. That's all. We do it all the time, don't we? We tee it up all the time. 1 in 100, it works.
It's very humbling when people do like a line. I know after that Hibs Cup final win, fans had it as their ringtone, and some guys got a tattoo and all that, which is humbling, but also a little bit embarrassing, because it is our job to capture the moment.
Dan, just to underline the futility in a way of what we do, it sounds like I'm doing down commentary, which I wouldn't do because I love it and it's my bread and butter, but it's the moment that matters. All we can do is get it right. And I've listened quite a lot. I do these archive shows for the BBC, the World Cup Rewinds and FA Cup Rewinds and what have you. And us three and all our colleagues and all that, I think of some of the, in quotes, great lines. And I think, were they great lines really? There were great goals. There were great moments. And all the commentator did was get it right. And then the line gets remembered. But it's the moment, really. You've just accompanied it. Was it a great line? Probably not. Kenneth Wollstone's was the greatest line of commentary ever because of the moment. Mm. I mean, that just, by all the gods, for that to fall just like that mid-sentence, that will never happen to anybody ever again. No. That is perfect. Everything was aligned beautifully, and he got it right. And that's all we can do, and touch wood and everything else. Long may we continue to carry on doing that.
I'm still dealing with the fact that some bloke in Edinburgh has got a tattoo that says standing on the brink of history.
With your face, Croc.
Sorry, also when Liam Henderson put the corner in, I said Henderson to deliver, and the goal was scored, so I carried on with the deliver. And some people have got that as a tattoo and a ringtone and whatever, and somebody made a song of it. So, as I say, it's great, but it is our job to, as Guy said, make that moment.
Well, I had my influences growing up as a commentator. David Coleman was, and Barry Davis were my two commentary heroes, and Hugh Johns, because growing up in the Midlands, we used to get, you know, obviously it was the big match in London on ITV on a Sunday. It was Star Soccer, where we grew up in Birmingham, in Solihull. So Hugh Johns was a real early hero of mine as a commentator. Yes, indeed, and that'll do it. And these lovely little phrases he used, which were the guys that enraptured you both?
Well, with the greatest of respect to those who've gone before and paved the way and made this job a possibility, and I doff my cap to them for that, for all of them. I never had a commentary hero because my heroes were players. I never thought I was going to be a football commentator. It's all happened by accident. So I still think I'd give it up tomorrow for one season playing number 9 for York City. I'm still a very frustrated individual in that sense. So I never really had heroes. Subconsciously, the voices I grew up with are still, funny enough, the voices I hear when I'm thinking of a commentary, if I'm getting prepared for it, I'm thinking of it. I don't hear my voice. I don't hear either of your two voices. I hear John Motson and Barry Davis and Clive Tilsley and Martin Tyler. They're the voices I hear. They're commentary voices to me. Mine isn't. Yours isn't. Croc's isn't. We're just the Johnny Come Latelys. So subconsciously, it's drip-fed. That is what commentary sounds like to me. But I wouldn't say they were ever heroes or ever thought, oh, I like what they do. I never really bought into it like that. I think the one I would say maybe, if I think of childhood memories, you've seen the Pixar film Inside Out where the core memories go in and they stick there. You know, I always think of that. I think it's a lovely film for things like that. And a core memory from my childhood would be the European nights, listening to Radio 2, sitting in the bath, listening to Peter Jones down a crackly telephone line from Bucharest. And that is probably the standout for me. I think, so if I was going to pick one, it would probably be Peter Jones, I think. But I don't really have commentary heroes, if I'm honest.
Funnily enough, I would say exactly the same, because when I used to go and watch my local non-league team, Weymouth, I used to take my little transistor radio, have it blaring out with all the reports and commentaries from the other games. And it was Peter Jones, such a fantastic voice, the likes of Brian Butler, Peter Lorenzo, and many more from that era, that really fueled the interest. And I thought, wow, that'd be a good job to have. And Peter Jones's voice was just outstanding. So it was from that era, that Sport On 2 era for me as well.
Yeah, yes. Brian Butler, his famous commentary on Maradona's second goal.
Like a little eel.
That's it. Just, and that's... For all budding commentators, it's just that ability to use language and vocabulary that...
Oh, I'm just hearing it now, Dan. And that is why he is the greatest footballer in the world. Oh, it's wonderful.
There's you, Croc, talking about having that part of your brain. You've not written that line down about, you know, standing on the brink of history, but you're there. The one part of your brain is doing what it's got to do and keep the verbal diarrhea going. But there's another part of your brain that's storing something for later. That's quite a unique skill.
Yeah, it's quite scary when you think about it, isn't it? Sometimes I remember texting Guy during the, I can't remember, it was a World Cup or toward the end of last season about something he'd said that I thought was good. And I think he replied saying something like, I prefer a nil-nil or something like that. And it is, when you're in the big games, and it is quite scary, but it's such a fantastic job that we do, and we're so lucky. So, yeah, you find a way around it. But I find there's so many things going on in your head during a game that when you actually stop at the end, you feel totally drained and tired because your focus and concentration has been so intense and immense.
You see, this is like a therapy session, actually. I'm finding this quite useful because I want to know. Because, yeah, we spend a lot of time on our own as well, don't we? Prepping games and then travelling and what have you. So there's a hell of a lot of time on our own, which is not good for me. I'm not good on my own. I don't like my own company particularly. So I'm relieved to hear you have the same thoughts and fears that I have. I'm sure we've all got the score wrong, or at some point had that cold chill where you genuinely, for a few seconds, have forgotten what the score is. I've done that a few times in a game, or suddenly you have that, I don't know what to say next. I don't know what to say. I don't know what's going to come out. I've had that before every single match as the teams come out. I find suddenly I can't swallow. I have to take water on board. Just hang on a minute. What's going to happen here? I don't know what's going to come out. And I can't swallow. And it happens that, actually, I would say 9 out of 10 games I cover, I have that moment where I can't swallow. I'm expecting it actually this weekend because it didn't happen last weekend. So it'll probably happen this weekend. And it's that inopportune time, just as the handover's coming, or just as you're about to start, and I suddenly go, oh God, dry mouth, here we go. And it still happens every single game. Pretty much. I have moments where I just think, what am I doing? And do you wander off during games as well sometimes? I start thinking, this is pointless. Why? This isn't a job. What am I doing here? It's ridiculous. This is all futile.
My problem is penalty shootouts. That's where my brain gets all mangled. You try and write things down. You put a tick or a cross, like you see on the graphics on the screen. But of course, you're looking at your sheet of paper. There's somebody walking from the halfway line. You've got to ID them as quickly as you can. Yeah. And normally they're side onto you. Wait a minute. Is that? Oh yeah, it is. I'm not a fan of penalty shootouts per se.
This will be an interesting season as well. Thank God away goals have gone from European games. It's not a hard concept, is it really? But why does it mess with our heads so much?
Yeah,
it shouldn't do.
when they took away goals out of the playoffs in the EFL 20 years ago, Birmingham City were the first team to flipping well suffer from no goals. We were up at Preston and Mark Rankin scores a goal that, you know, would have meant nothing in the context of an away aggregate score. And we end up going out on penalties and Trevor threatens to take the players off the pitch because he wants the pens taken at the open end, which is reconstructed. Oh, God.
No for York City to ever have to be bothered by away goals. God, just scoring a home goal would bloody help.
Yeah. But look, I've got to talk to you about this before we wrap up because I work in radio and we have our place in the press box, but you guys work on gantries. And gantries are never always the safest places either to stand on or to access. I've seen people climb up that ladder at Fratton Park to get to the TV gantry at Portsmouth, which never looked particularly fun. I gather Roker Park was a similar fraught experience. Are there any that stand out being particularly frightening?
I love them. I love them. The older and more rickety, the better. Honestly, I really do. I don't like the modern grounds where you're just at the back of the stand and just to part with everybody else. I like a dodgy ladder. The old one at St Andrews that they used to take away. I mean, the health and safety issues there. You know, if you weren't up there half an hour before the game, well, the ladder's going. Correct. What happens if there's a fire? Ooh, we haven't thought about that. And in that old wooden stand, there was every chance. Never happened, thankfully. But, you know, what happens if you need to go to the toilet? You know, I like that. I do like it. Hands and knees, crawling under things to get there. Yeah, there was one at Hartlepool against Nottingham Forest in the ITV days, early 2000s, and it was a League Cup tie in August, end of August. It was still freezing in Hartlepool. And they didn't have a TV gantry at Hartlepool or Victoria Park. I don't suppose they still do. So they basically erected some scaffolding on the roof of the stand with a bit of tarpaulin over to keep the wind and rain off. And throughout the first half, I was mindful there was something under my foot and I was jabbing it. I was like, that's not comfortable. I couldn't move my chair. And it was like a dining room chair, but they just put one up there on the roof. And I'm sort of digging away at it, thinking, what is that? What is that? And I was kicking it constantly during the thing, saying, get out of the way. What is that? And I looked down at half time when I got a moment and there was a dead seagull that had been there and I kicked it that much. It was a mangled mess and all over my boot.
Oh,
and that's one of the worst I've ever experienced, and I nearly retched. It was not a pretty sight, but that was an interesting one.
Rob, yeah, that Portsmouth ladder climb used to give me nightmares, and Ninian Park was a bit like that as well. And you're doing it in front of fans a lot of the time as well, so
Ninian Park, wow,
they're kind of willing you to fall off or look an idiot. And you get to the top of that Portsmouth ladder and then you still had a big step over to actually get onto the gantry. But I'm a guy, I like the old school stadiums. In Scotland, did a game at Arbroath, which is right by the North Sea. The gantry is actually literally right by the North Sea. It's just down below. It's really windy as it always is there. And they said to me, you're going to have to wear a safety harness. I went, get away. There's no way a fat commentator is going to be blown into the North Sea. I got out of that gantry and I thought, actually, that might not have been a bad idea because it was an absolute hurricane. But proper old grounds, yeah, brilliant.
The old days at Goodison Park with the ladder on the outside of the stand, which is now, and I think regretfully, it's now encased, isn't it? And I remember it when it didn't used to be and it was just a ladder on the side that actually leant a little bit backwards as well. I used to get a perverse pleasure from going up there. I used to like that. And then right across the Goodison roof, I love that. I still love going there.
Yeah, Celtic, as you'll know, guys, Celtic, yeah, the roof as well, isn't it?
It's when it's blowing, it's a little bit risky up there. But what a view! My goodness, what a view once you're there.
But also with the grounds that you go to, Croc, particularly you, Croc, but probably more so than you, Guy, Sky will build you a temporary commentary position because there simply isn't a stand to accommodate you.
Yeah, when we had the Scottish Cup rights, there was a lot of that when you go to the smaller grounds, and I remember going to Peterhead once, which is right north of Aberdeen. They were playing Rangers when Rangers were out of the top flight. They put a sort of scaffolding in, but they left it completely open because it was like the first game of the season, so it was August. And they obviously assumed that the weather might be decent, but this is Scotland. So we turned up and it's blowing a hurricane as well. It's started to rain. We're just standing there like that with all the rain coming down. And so many places like that. But hey, it gives you stories to tell. for sure.
Honestly, we have it for the early FA Cup ties as well with the BBC at the moment. And my it's funny, isn't it? My favourite game of last season, it wasn't England-Italy at Wembley for the European Championship final. Genuinely, my favourite game, my standout moment last season was Marine against Spurs in the FA Cup. I absolutely adored everything about that day, right up to the temporary scaffold on the roof of the stand. They're the best days. That's what makes football.
Yeah, the balls going into those people's back gardens.
Oh, that was brilliant, wasn't it? Absolutely brilliant.
What it's all about.
But listen, before we... because we're nearly out of time, we're nearly an hour in. Now, I can't remember the last time you did radio. Have you done any radio?
I did a bit of talk sport when I was freelancing when Satanta went bust, did a couple of games then. It's been a long time and I actually miss it because I really love doing radio because you are painting the pictures and, you know... I really enjoyed doing Capital Radio and then BRMB and a bit of talk. And actually missed doing the radio, but we can't come and steal your jobs, can we? So, you know, but I do what we do. But radio is so great purely because, you know, everyone is relying on you, whereas on TV, you know, sometimes I still do anyway. We just state the bleeding obvious that people can see in front of you.
That snap, I was just about to say, I'm not as gracious as Crocs. I was about to try and cheekily steal everybody's job. By saying that, you know, I am available if anybody would like to give me a radio gig because I really miss it. I haven't done one for years. I'm not seem to be wanted. Never mind. We're busy enough as it is, and we know that. But yeah, I'd love to go back to doing a bit of radio every now and again. It is the finest medium for a commentator. I think it's the natural medium for a commentator, isn't it? I think we can just get in the way if we get it wrong.
What was the last radio commentary you did then? How far back are we going?
Leicester's title-winning season, halfway through. So was that 15, 16, was it? That would be the last one I did. That was, not done one since. I don't think I did it that badly, but there we are.
Was that four then?
That was Five Live, yeah. Oh, yeah. Five, but they've got their own people in place. So we understand that, though. We can't do everything, even though we want to. We can't do everything and be everywhere. But, yeah, I'm the same as Carl. I've got Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, World Cup qualifiers. So there's plenty going on. And I have to say, we're only a week into the new sort of season at the top level, and it's brilliant, isn't it? It's brilliant. What do we do? I love my cricket, I love my golf, like everybody else does, but yeah, you can't beat this.
I said a really bad word on the radio once, Dance, as well, which I've not repeated on television yet, but it was your team, Birmingham City, and I was getting some information in my headphones about goals from elsewhere. Just at that moment, I kind of lost concentration, and I was trying to say, Jonathan Hunt cuts inside. How it came out, and I've still got it on tape somewhere. And I was with Tom Ross, and we couldn't stop giggling for the next half hour. Like, how professional was that?
I had a similar one on Metro Radio years ago involving Crew Alexandra's Kenny Lunt.
Oh, yes.
Which yes. Eric Gates, the great Eric Gates, was my co-com, and he very helpfully said, do his mates call him Lenny, live on air? And that was it, that we couldn't speak for about 10 minutes.
See, our professionalism is often tested. You won't know this guy, but Croc had to was the last person to leave Norwich City one night with Tom, having had to stick around till 7 o'clock to do a phone in, and there was literally nobody left inside Carrow Road, was there?
No, they closed the ground, and Tom did his phone until 7. I just sit there because obviously we drove together and sit around waiting, and suddenly, like, hang on, there's nobody here. So we went down the stand and we found this door, and it was one of those push to exit things. So we pushed to exit and they set all the alarms off around Carrow Road. So we just like raced to the car park. There was another incident at Grimsby on a freezing winter's day where we had to hang around, whilst Tom did the phone until 7 o'clock. And they closed the gates as well. And we had to prise the gate open like that, and it just wouldn't come very far and try and get through.
Just a quick one, Grimsby. You've just jogged my memory. Grimsby, the old days of Sun City 103.4 Supersport, coming in your ears and all that. Grimsby v Sunderland, which was actually live on Tyne Tees and probably in the Yorkshire region as well on Sunday afternoon. It was in the 95-96 season that Sunderland got promoted under Peter Reid. I'm still convinced to this day I fused the floodlights at Blundell Park. I had a bit of kit, which we were very cheap. We didn't have Glen Sound, which is the standard way of your ISDN broadcasting. We didn't have that. We had a thing called a mini Minx mixer, which was one way. They could hear me But I had to have a phone to get my cue to hear them, to hear the studio. I got my cue off the phone and then, right, you're off. And then I would just broadcast. It was just a one-way circuit. Now, half the time, it was a BT line that I had to take the top off, get my two bits of wire in, and with a screwdriver, manually get these two bits of wire screwed in and connecting until somebody on the phone said, yes, we can hear you now on the microphone. We can hear you. Now, at Blundell Park that day, as I finally made connection, having demolished the BT box, taken it to bits, as I've got my screwdriver in, and just as they went, you can hear me, all the floodlights went off at that exact point. And there was a 10-15 minute delay to the match. And I'm convinced that that was me. I've had all sorts of things like that. I remember as well kicking the life out of a point at Old Trafford, much to the dismay of a guy called Peter Smith, who was the club call reporter. We still see him a lot in the Northwest, dear old Pete. And Pete reminds me of it every now and again. I remember his face when he got there. I said, what have you done to my point? And there were bits of plastic everywhere. I'd kicked it in to get access to it. And he, you're going to have to put that back together. And I remember looking at him with these bits of plastic in my hand, just shrugging my shoulders, going, what do I do now? Got great pleasure kicking the life out of something at Old Trafford. Quite fun.
I mean, you guys will remember this maybe from your radio days, but as a radio commentator, there is no greater sight than seeing the red and green lights come on your Glen Sound radio box to know that you've connected via your ISDN line to the studio. The sheer terror of dialing the number and wondering, is it going to work today?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I still have those two bits of wire in my bag and I carry them to every single game that I go to. It's just a superstition now. I still have the same two bits of green and yellow fuse.
Well, next time it's a floodlight failure, I know where to look.
I remember those days where you used to have to wire in as well. And I don't know about you, but DIY, I can't. If I can change the fuse, that is a major achievement for me. So actually, how we managed to wire in back in the days. But thankfully, technology has taken over now.
Yeah, it's trying to keep up with the technology. That's the problem for a Luddite like me. Listen, gentlemen, we will leave it there. We could do another hour and still not properly scratch the surface. I wish you well with the rest of the season. I'm sure I'll see you guys around here, there and everywhere as the season continues. Guy, continued success with Match of the Day and the FA Cup and everything that goes with it for the BBC. It's been a pleasure having you on, fella.
Cheers. Can't wait to see you both.
And Croc, I know I saw you last Saturday at Everton. I'm sure our paths will cross pitch side at some point somewhere down the line.
Be good for us all to catch up in the media room having a hot lunch one day soon with a bit of luck, rather than going straight to the gantry and ignoring everyone.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Ian Crocker and Guy Mowbray have been my first guests on The Commentator's Curse. Hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, there's every chance you're going to hear more of these. So thank you for your time. Thanks to Guy and Croc, and we'll see you next time on The Commentator's Curse.